We are admittedly in a time of great turmoil and confusion in the church. It's also called the Israel of God in the New Testament in Galatians 6, verse 14. And oftentimes we find the strength to help us to understand the Israel of God by looking at the Israel in the Old Testament. As we wonder how to conduct ourselves, as we wonder what to do, as we look at the flawed leadership in the Church of God, we wonder, what would God have us to do in these times? I want you to turn to Ezekiel chapter 34. It's a chapter that on our elders' forum, Don Ward, he said, read Ezekiel 34 a couple of dozen times. It's a good read. It's a scary read. It's a prophetic read. And it's a helpful one considering the days in which we live. I want to just, and I would suggest, I suspect you probably have, but go back and study it a couple of dozen times if you need to, and pay close attention to what it says. Ezekiel 34, verse 1, said, "And the Lord, word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel." Now, this is one of those dual prophecies, and certainly it's talking about Israel, the extended Israel and Abraham's seed and the nations of Israel today and the leadership. And if you do a commentary study, it'll say the shepherds oftentimes refer to the king, to the leader of a nation. But this is also, I believe, a prophecy about God's church, the Israel of God, and an end time prophecy. So, son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel if they fall into this category. And again, read the entirety, this is just an introduction to what I'm going to talk about. Verse 7, "Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As surely as I live, says the sovereign Lord, you abandoned my flock. You left them to be attacked by every wild animal. And though you were my shepherds, you didn't search for my sheep when they were lost. You took care of yourselves and left the sheep to starve. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I now consider these shepherds my enemies, and I will hold them responsible for what has happened to my flock." I mean, I literally have trembled in reading this, because there's a great responsibility that God places upon his ministry and what we do and how we treat the sheep and how we fulfill God's word. And so God says, I'm taking notice, I'm watching. And I would have to say, for better or for worse. Now, what do we do, though, when the shepherds fail or when the shepherds fall? Verse 11 continues, giving us an answer. It says, "For thus says the Lord, indeed, I myself will search for my sheep and seek them out." You know, we feel as though we're abandoned, or feel as though, you know, we haven't been treated well or whatever. But God says, I myself, and this is speaking to you, it's speaking to each one of us, because I too am a sheep. But it says, "I indeed myself will search for my sheep." God is with you. What's going to happen to you? Well, you're faithful to God. It says God will seek you out in whatever way he chooses to do it. He's capable, is he not? Verse 12, "As a shepherd seeks out his flock in the day he's among the scattered sheep." Again, I believe this is a prophecy. He talks about the scattered sheep. And indeed, we are scattered. I don't think there's going to be some great movement to gather all of the scattered sheep in until Christ returns, when the great shepherd brings his sheep in. And again, this can talk about the nations of Israel and the world in general, that God is going to bring people back to him. But as far as just a personal relationship between you and God, he says, "So I will seek out my sheep and deliver them from all the places where they were scattered on a cloudy and dark day." You're going through some dark times. a cloudy day, he says, I will seek you out. Verse 15, I myself, God says, will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord. You know, in the end, well, not in the end, but a great general principle he gives us is that we need to have judgment, mercy, and faith. I mean, do we have faith that when he says he will take care of you as the sheep, he will take care of you? That's part of it. Your salvation does not depend on a physical shepherd, even in a spiritual organization. It depends on the shepherd who says he will deliver us. Verse 16, I will search the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak. The prophecy is that among his flock there will be injured and weak. It's not like the flock is always just going to be fed the solid fields and drink all of the best water. It says there's going to be a time when the sheep are actually injured and need to be strengthened because they're weak. It says, but the sleek and strong I will destroy. Seems like an odd statement until you continue to see what he says about the sheep. I will shepherd the flock with justice, mercy, judgment, and faith. Now, verse 17. Now, we can look at the ministry and say, what are they thinking? Why aren't they doing what they tell us we should do? And why aren't they getting along? And why are they going separate ways and not doing what the basic principles are? And valid questions. But we can't toss it off and say, it's them. It's just them. Because verse 17 says, as for you, my flock. Okay, so this is talking to you, whoever you are, if you're a part of God's flock. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I will judge between one sheep and another, between rams and goats. So God is not only watching the ministry as to what we do, he's watching the sheep. And he said he is judging between how you treat one another, between your relationship with one another, just as surely as he's taking the shepherds into account. And he says, between the rams and the goats. And then verse 18, he says, is it not enough for you to feed on the good pasture? God opens your mind. He gives you the truth of God, of eternal salvation and the kingdom of God and all the doctrines that it entails and all of those things. And he says, I've given that to you, but is that not good enough? He said, must you also trample the rest of your pasture with your feet? Is it you get, well, I got to get mine. You know, and you're getting yours, and then you're trampling out the rest of the pasture and somebody else can't feed because you've destroyed something that could cause them to be nourished. And he says, is it not enough for you to drink the clear water? Must you muddy the waters for somebody else? And so he asks us each individually to look and see, am I muddying the waters for another member? Is something I'm doing, is something I'm saying, clouding the pasture or the water? Or is it helping others towards the kingdom? Am I encouraging them? And it's just a personal thing that we each have to ask ourselves. And then he says, verse 22, therefore I will save my flock. Promise. Okay, and this can be, again, when Jesus Christ returns, he's going to save Israel. In the great white throne judgment, he's going to bring people back to life and save them, and he's going to see them through. But on a basis with the Israel of God, you and me, he says, I will therefore save my flock, and they shall no longer be a prey, and I will judge between sheep and sheep. And then he says, verse 23, I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. Now, certainly this refers to the son of David. You look in the New Testament, and many, many times it refers to Jesus as the son of David. And so it is Christ who is the overall shepherd, But indeed, this David is going to be working under Christ, working with Israel. He may be over you and me as our supervisor in the kingdom. Oh, and then it goes on to say, he shall feed them and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God. My servant David, a prince among them, I, the Lord, have spoken. So he says in the future, he's going to save the nations of Israel because David is going to be ruling under Christ over these nations. He tells us that he's going to send us a David, but do we have him now? Turn to Acts chapter 13. Acts chapter 13. And Paul is giving a sermon here. And I think it's interesting in Acts chapter 13 and verse 15. It says, after reading from the law and the prophets, the synagogue rulers sent word to them saying, brothers, if you have a message of encouragement for the people, please speak. Indeed, we need a message of encouragement for the people. Now, this is only a part of that sermon. One part of that sermon of encouragement for the people is this. If you go to verse 20, it says, all this took about 450 years when he's going through the children of Israel in the wilderness. It says, after this, God gave them judges until the time of Samuel the prophet. Verse 21, then the people asked for a king, and he gave them Saul, the son of Kish, the tribe of Benjamin, who ruled 40 years. And verse 22, and after removing Saul, he made David their king. And he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do his will. So he said he sent David to Israel, to those who were alive at that time, to rescue them. I sent David to them. He says that in the future he's going to send David to Israel to be over them, to rescue them, to be a shepherd over them. Wouldn't it be interesting if today, instead of if we had Mr. Luker as president of the United Church of God, if we had David, what if God could send David and we could look at him and we could look at his example and we could learn from him, and he sent David to us to show us what to do in this time of turmoil in the church? Well, you know, the Bible gives us the legacy of Scripture to help us through these times. And although God's not going to resurrect David now and he's going to wait till Christ returns, he's given us an example of David to help us through these times. As surely as David helped ancient Israel, will help future Israel, he sent David to us now. We won't turn there, but 2 Timothy 3:16 says that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable. It says that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped to every good work. So it's when we look in the Scriptures that we see things that can help us through these tough times. And today, I want to look through the life of David. I want to look through the life of David, and I think the examples that are there show us what we can do when a shepherd falls, and what our attitude needs to be before God. It's very, very instructional. And I would admonish you to take the time to make this a study. Just going through, and I'm going to summarize this today, but go back and read it and say, God, David was a man after your own heart. Am I a man after your own heart by following what David did and what his example was? 1 Samuel chapter 8. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, and we're going to cover about an 80-year period of time. Now, I mentioned this to some of you beforehand, but this is the Sabbath that I'm here, and we have our sermon and Bible study. This is two short messages, as the messages ought to be, instead of one long message. So we will take a break in between here, and then we'll get to the second message after a break. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, I think it's interesting to start when we talk about the story of David and why David was a man after God's own heart. Was David a man after God's own heart because he was just so good? He did everything right. You know, he was righteous in everything before God. Well, I think we'll find that's not the case. We do know. You've read these things before. But let's see why David was a man after God's own heart and see if we can learn how to handle the situations we're going through now. Verse 1 says, Samuel grew old. You know, we've talked in the church now about the aging ministry. Well, Samuel was the aging ministry at that point. He appointed his sons as judges for Israel. And verse 3, his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, accepted bribes, and perverted justice. So even as the form of government that God had set up with the judges, we find that even that wasn't a perfect system because Samuel's sons weren't following his way. And so you found fault with the shepherds there. And verse 4, so all the elders of Israel gathered and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, you're old, and your sons don't walk in your ways. Now appoint us a king to lead us, such as other nations have. Now it had been under the system of Moses, and you go back to Acts, we're not going back there, but Acts 13, it goes through and says, well, God gave them Moses, and then he gave them the judges, and now they're asking for a king, as that it said. And now appoint us a king to lead us, such as the nations have. But when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel. That's not the form of government God set up. What are you guys trying to do? So he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, listen to all the people are saying to you. It's not you they have rejected. They rejected me as their king. A pretty powerful statement. And so what did God do? Did he wipe them off the face of the earth like he said he was going to do with Moses a couple of times? Now he says, as they have done from the day I brought them out of Egypt this day, they're forsaking me and serving other gods. And so they're doing to you. And then it says, verse 9, now listen to them. They want a king, they're going to get a king. But warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do. He said, you're setting up a new form of government here, which is not the one that I set up, but I'm allowing you to do it. But you realize your form of government is going to come with some problems. And just be ready for it. I think in principle that's the same thing that has happened with the United Church of God, for example. I don't think you can show from the Bible that you know, there's just one man at all times, you know, and so forth. But there are a number of different forms. And my personal feeling is that I don't think this form of government we have set up with United is the thing that will save us. In fact, I know that. Okay, it's got flaws, but I believe God is with it. I think probably when we were forming United back in 95, God said, well, okay, you know, we had one man rule with Mr. Armstrong, and now this is something different. Yeah, maybe it's not the best, but go ahead. Just deal righteously when you do it. Okay, and I'll be with you through it. And I believe God is with us through it, but I think there was a warning with that, and we're suffering the consequences of not doing the handling it the way we might. Verse 18, it says, when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you've chosen. The Lord will not answer you in that day. This is the form of government you wanted. This is the form of government you get. And when you come crying to me, he says, I'm not going to answer you. You're just going to suffer the consequences. So we're come crying to God. God, we need a different form of government. We need something else. And he says, okay, what you wanted, you got. Verse 19, but the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. And then we'll be like all the other nations with a king to lead us and go up before us and fight our battles. Samuel heard all the people said and repeated it before the Lord. And the Lord answered, listen, give them a king. And so they got what they wanted. Chapter 9 and goes down to Samuel going out and finding Saul. And at the very end of verse 20, it says, to whom Saul is the desire of Israel turned, because he was handsome, he stood a foot above everybody else. And if not to you and all your father's family. And Saul answered, but I'm just a Benjamite of the smallest tribes of Israel. And isn't my clan the smallest of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me? He said, I don't deserve to be king. I'm not qualified. He was humble in his own eyes to begin with. And he was selected to be king, and God gave his blessing on that. Samuel chapter 10, 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 1. Samuel took a flask of oil, poured it on Saul's head, kissed him, saying, has not the Lord anointed you to be leader over his inheritance? So God blessed this form of government that they wanted set up. Verse 23. They ran and brought him out as he stood among the people, his head taller than any others. And Samuel said to the people, you see this man the Lord has chosen? There's no one like him among all the people. And the people shouted, long live the king! And verse 25, and Samuel explained to the people the regulations of the kingship. In other words, he set up the bylaws whereby if you're going to have a king as your form of government, these are the rules you follow. You know, United set up its bylaws, and we go by the bylaws that were established. And again, I believe God was with what has been done. He wrote them down on a scroll. He deposited it before the Lord. So all the bylaws were set up. They were there, you'd look to, and you'd follow them. Samuel dismissed the people to his own home. And I think it was interesting that even from the beginning, and Israel was a type of spiritual Israel in a lot of ways. Even from the beginning, notice verse 27, but some troublemakers said, how can this fellow save us? We don't like this guy as being king. And I expect they had in their mind who would have been a better king. But it's not the way it was. They despised him. They brought him no gifts. But Saul said, it's all right. I don't take any offense to it. A little later on, verse 12 of chapter 11, says, the people then said to Samuel, who is it that asked shall Saul reign over us? Bring out these men and we'll put them to death. These guys didn't want Saul. Saul's our king. God made him king. And Saul said, no, nobody's going to be put to death today. This is the day God rescued Israel. I'm not out to get anybody. Okay, so Saul ended up with a decent attitude, at least to begin with. Chapter 12, interesting, in verse 13. Samuel said, now here's the king you've chosen, the one you asked for, and see, the Lord has set a king over you. He got involved in that government. Verse 14, if you fear the Lord and serve and obey him and do not rebel against his commandments, both you and the king who reigns over you, follow the Lord your God, good. He said, you got to follow my commandments. I come first. Yeah, I've got a king over you, but I come first. King's not over you, I'm over you. Okay, so you always obey me first. Set that ground rule. Verse 15, if you do not obey the Lord, and if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you as it was against their fathers. Verse 22, for the sake of his great name, the Lord will not reject his people, because the Lord was pleased to make you his own. You are my people. Even under this circumstance, and with the king, there's going to be some problems. Verse 23, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you. It's interesting that Samuel said, God, they're making this bad choice. God said, I know it. Give him a king. I'll be with him. And then Samuel said, it would be a sin if I failed to pray for Israel, even under this circumstance. He says, and I will teach you the way that is good and right, but be sure to fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart. Consider the great things he has done for you. Don't disobey God, okay? Otherwise, things will really go bad for you. In chapter 13, we find that Samuel, although he started off pretty strong and did some powerful battles and that type of thing, he ends up making an illegal offering before God. It would be the equivalent of violating one of the bylaws, if you will. Okay, this is the rule. You don't make the offering Samuel does. And he said, well, I couldn't wait. I just had to get that offering out there because God wasn't taking care of it. God wasn't coming through for me. And so he rushed that offering through and said, I got to take it into my hands. And God said, no, you don't. And it says, verse 13, he said, you acted foolishly. You've not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. And notice verse 14. It's very interesting in the story because we're talking about David. And we get the introduction to David. He says, the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. Saul fell. Their shepherd fell. He violated the bylaws, if you will. In verse 15, and Samuel left Gilgal, went up to Gibeah, Benjamite. Saul counted the men were there. See, that's not where I know to go. Chapter. Oh, just back to these two verses when he said, you acted foolishly, and I'm going to take the kingdom away and give it to a man after my own heart, which we know is David. How long was it from the time God said, I'm taking the kingdom from you and giving it to somebody else, was it before the kingdom was taken from Saul and given to somebody else? Anybody? 30 years. This was 30 years later David would finally become king. When you talk about having trust in God and patience. Okay. So what do you do when a shepherd falls? Do you need to help? Did God need somebody's help in bringing down Saul's kingdom? I don't believe so. About 5 years after this event, God commands Saul to kill all the Amalekites and the animals. And we know that story. Saul messed up. He didn't kill anybody. And now God's taking him to task in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 17. This is about 25 years before God takes away the reign from Saul. Let's see, chapter 15, verse 17. Samuel said, although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel and sent you on a mission saying, go complete law, destroy the wicked people. Verse 19, why did you not obey the Lord? And what did Saul say? Oh, I don't know, I'm just such a bad guy. I just really messed up. No, he said, I did obey the Lord. From his viewpoint, he was doing exactly what God said. We can be so easily deceived. It said, I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites. I did bring back Agag, their king. And the soldiers, well, they took the sheep and the cattle for plunder and the best of what was devoted to God. I did this for you, God. I mean, don't you see? I'm doing this for all the right reasons. Saul said, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal. And then Samuel replied that famous statement that we know so well. Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much in obedience to the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than to sacrifice. To heed is better than the fat of rams. And then he says, verse 23, rebellion is like the sin of divination or the sin of witchcraft. and arrogance, like evil of idolatry. Because you rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. So twice now he'd been rejected as king. Now you would think that this would be a good time for someone to come in and become king, wouldn't you? We might just use human nature, but God gave David as an example for us, I think. And Saul said to Samuel in verse 24, I've sinned and please forgive me. And Samuel told Saul, verse 26, I'm not going to go back with you. You've rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel. And verse 28, and Samuel said, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind. He's not a man that he should change his mind. I'm going to replace you because you were disobedient. Saul replied, I have sinned, but please honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel and come back with me so I may worship the Lord your God, he asked Samuel. The king fell again. The shepherd fell. You notice even at this, when he had rebelled against God, he said, Samuel, please come back with me, otherwise people are just going to reject me as being the king altogether. And what did Samuel do? So Samuel went back with Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. So Saul keeps reigning, even though God said, I've taken him away. Chapter 16, verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul? Since I've rejected him as king over Israel, fill your horn with oil. Be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse, son of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king. In verse 13, says, so Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed David in the presence of his brothers, and from that day the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. So here is the heir apparent. I mean, the one God says going to take over from Saul. And verse 14, and the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit of the Lord tormented him. David given power from God, power taken away from Saul by God. So what do you do when a shepherd falls? If you were David, and Samuel came to you and said, the Lord has anointed you to be king. He's just removed Saul from being king. What do you do when you're David? Says what he did. David, a man after God's own heart. Let this tell us something. Verse 21, David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. And then Saul sent word to Jesse, saying, allow David to remain in my service, for I am pleased with him. What did David do? He went under the service of the king. He did not try to take over the kingship, even when the Spirit of God had come upon Saul. I mean, come upon David and away from Saul. I forgot an important verse back here in chapter 15 and verse 35. At the end of verse 35, and it said, the Lord was grieved that he had made Saul king over Israel. It's interesting that God said, I had so much hopes for this young man. I thought he would be a good king, and then Saul took things into his own hands and didn't obey God and handled things wrongly, and he said it grieved God he had made Saul king. I'm sorry this guy's still here. But he didn't remove him, even God, for 25 years after this. Okay, so David is Saul's servant. Chapter 17, David becomes a national hero by killing Goliath. Chapter 18 and verse 5 tells you something again about David. It says, whatever Saul sent David to do, David did it successfully. Saul the king told David, go and do this, and David went and did it. He was under a shepherd that had fallen, a shepherd that was not a good example, a shepherd that God had even rejected, and David did whatever Saul told him to do. And then it says Saul gave him a high rank in the army. So now David is moved up by Saul, not from David's own doing. David still considered himself unworthy, although he was doing Saul's will, as long as it didn't cause him to disobey God. So he got a high rank in the army, and this pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. And then David would come back, and the ladies would sing, Saul has killed his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. And Saul got angry because David was being looked at instead of Saul. And so, verse 8, Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. He started looking to him instead of to me. And then, as time went on, we find that, here again, David had no aspirations to become king, even though he had been anointed by Samuel to eventually become king. Verse 17, Saul said to David, this is chapter 18, verse 17, here is my older daughter, Merib, and I will give her to you in marriage, only serve me bravely and fight the battles for the Lord. And Saul said to himself, I won't raise a hand against him, but the Philistines will probably kill him. And David said to Saul, who am I, and what is my father and my father's clan in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law? He was not politicizing. He was not trying to get himself a position. He wasn't trying to worm his way in. If I could just marry Saul's daughter, then I could be king, like God wants me to anyway. It was not in his mind. He was a man after God's own heart. Why? Not because he killed a bunch of people, because he couldn't build the temple because of that. So David certainly wasn't perfect in this. One way he was that he was faithful to his boss. He was a good example of being faithful to the one who is your boss, even though your boss is less than perfect. He did end up marrying Saul's daughter, Michal. But even at that, verse 23, they repeated the words to David. David said, do you think it's a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and little known. Very humble in the whole thing. He was not political in this. 1 Samuel 1, or 19 and verse 1. And then we find Saul so jealous. Remember, he had placed David in a high rank. He had had him marry his daughter, and so like heir apparent type stuff. And Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. Jonathan, go kill David. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him, my father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard. Now here is what, and other questions come up. Well, yeah, okay, so what about, there's this ruler and he's evil. He's a fallen shepherd, and then he tells you to disobey God. Remember, God said, do all I tell you. So now it comes up, and if Jonathan is to obey the king, his father, he disobeys God. So he does not obey the king. There are instances where circumstances come up, and if the king, whether it be your boss at work, whether it be ministry, whether it be, you know, an organization, whatever asks you to disobey God, you ought to obey God rather than man. That's where you begin to really draw lines. That's what happened with Worldwide, for those of us that were around in the mid-90s, is it came to a point where it was not a matter of, well, you can continue, and I'm not going to make you do anything to disobey God. But then it came to either the Sabbath is done away with. You need to teach that type of thing. And I would not teach against God's law. And I had to separate from the king, if you will, from the established authority, because they were going against God and asking me to go against God. I stayed with I resigned from Worldwide a year and a half before 95, and that split that occurred. And I stayed with them and was served the sheep faithfully while I could. But then when it came down to a matter of obeying God's law or not, we had to obey God rather than man. It wasn't a matter of just I didn't care for the people that were over me or whatever. In chapter 22, verse 1, David left Gath because Saul was still after him and escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brothers and his father's household told him about it, they went to him there. Verse 2, and all those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their leader, about 400 men with him. Now granted, here's David, and he goes out from under the king's rule because he was run out, because he'd be killed if he stayed. It was not God's will he be killed. And then there were a bunch of people who were not paying their debts, people who were disenfranchised with the leadership, that were discontent, as it says, and they all went and said, hey, David, you know, well, we don't like the king anymore. And David said, well, I like the king, but he didn't like me. And it does say he became their leader. But again, if we go on to see how David handled things when his shepherd had fallen, I think we do see what his attitude is. Chapter 22, verse 13. Now this is when Saul had come and received from food from a high tub. Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me? There's the king. He said, why have you conspired against me and the son of Jesse? So you and David have conspired against me, giving him bread and a sword and inquiring of God, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today. So Saul said, David is rebelling against me. And Ahimelech answered the king and says, who of your servants, all your servants, is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law? Even after he had had his high position in the army taken away, had been expelled, and Saul was trying to kill him, Ahimelech was able to say, who of all your servants is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard, and highly respected in your household? Was that day the first time I inquired of God for him? Yeah, I prayed for him before. This last time I was praying for him and helping him out. I've done that all through the time because he's your loyal servant. He's just kind of being cast out right now. Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant or any of his father's family, for your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair. There is no conspiracy. There's no rebellion against you, King Saul. And there wasn't, because that wasn't in David's heart. He was just on the lam, if you will. We find what was in David's heart, as David is a man after God's own heart, in chapter 24. One you're familiar with, but I think it's worth a read of all of 1 Samuel 24. Verse 1, it says, after Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, it was told, David's in the desert of En-Gedi, and Saul took 3,000 chosen men of all Israel, set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. Verse 3, and he came to the sheep pens along the way, and a cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. So Saul is going in away from his men to do what people need to do. Your King James Version says cover his feet, and we hope he didn't cover his feet. I guess the robe went over him as he squatted down. Anyway, we don't need to get distracted with that. And so the men said, okay, so the men are hiding in the cave, and here comes Saul, and he's squatting down to do what people do when they squat down. And the men said, this is the day the Lord spoke of. We're only quoting scripture. Okay, it's already said that Samuel told you you would be king. This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. And David crept up unnoticed. So David, a man after God's own heart. Now, I think even wanting to do the right thing, we sometimes get a little bit carnal. I mean, I do. I've expressed to you, I fight that carnality. I've been fighting it a lot the last several weeks. But he came up, and he didn't kill him. He wasn't going to do that because he knew it wasn't right. But he said, wouldn't it be cool if we could just, if I just sneak up there and I'll just cut a piece of his robe off, and then he'll go out of there, you know, without this piece of his robe? Wouldn't that be funny? And I don't know if that's what was going through his mind, because I'm not that much a man after David's heart, but it seems as though this is what was going on. It's to me, I've likened it like I am actually pretty good at something bad, and that's like being sarcastic and picking up on things and exposing things and writing things that are biting and that type of thing, and I have done so in the past. I did that with the worldwide separation in 95, and there's a lot of things that I have repented of that it's kind of like cutting off the corner of the robe, you know. And I did right in leaving, but not in cutting off the corner of the robe in the way I acted. And so I got to examine myself. I kind of see that as the way David is here. He's got this would really be cool. I had a thing that I was going to write on Elders Forum for the ministry a couple of weeks ago, and I said, this is really funny, and I had a little video clip and everything, that, and I sent it to a couple of friends because, you know, well, I know they thought it'd be kind of cute, but I thought, well, this I shouldn't send it on Elders Forum because it's, like, not really nice, even though it's funny. And if I ask my wife, she'll definitely say no. So I sent it to these four guys, and to a man, they wrote back and said, don't do it. The one Chuck Zimmerman, he said, this is one of those things that you write out of frustration and then press the delete key. So I wrote back and said, I pressed the delete key. So you feel like cutting off the robe sometime, but we're looking for the attitude of God. You don't do what pleases our carnal nature. Pride, what makes us feel good or look good. We do what God wants us to. So after he did that, verse 5, afterward David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. Remember, David was the next in line. And God had rejected Saul as king, and David was still conscience-stricken over what he had said about Saul, or did about Saul. And he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master. He's still my boss, even though he was a shepherd that had fallen. He's still my boss. And he says, Lord forbid I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, nor lift up my hand against him, for he is the anointed of the Lord. God hasn't taken him away. David had a chance to take him away and remove him. God said he was going to remove him. I'm just doing God's will. Verse 7, with these words, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. Saul left the cave and went his way. To me, it's instructional on an attitude that I think God wants us to have towards the person who might be your boss, towards a husband-wife relationship. I mean, don't treat people badly, and especially if God's given them some rule over you. David went out of the cave, verse 8, and said to Saul, my lord the king. When Saul looked at him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. The guy tried to kill him. And he said to Saul, why do you listen when men say David is bent on harming you? This day you've seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. I see this as God gave David an opportunity here to grab the kingdom. If he'd done it, he'd have had the kingdom. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lift up my hand against my master because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, I took this piece of your robe in my hand and I cut off the corner of your robe, but I didn't kill you. I even feel bad about being disrespectful. Now understand and recognize I'm not guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you're hunting me down to take my life. I've had to leave your presence. I'm on the lam here. But he said, I'm not trying to kill you, even though you're trying to kill me. May the Lord, verse 12, may the Lord judge between you and me. And may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me. But I will not put forth my hand to touch you. As the saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds. So my hand will not touch you. I'm not going to rise up against the king. Verse 14, he said, against whom has the king of Israel come out? And whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? I mean, I'm the one that you made, you know, high position in the army. May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand. And God said, I will deliver you shepherds. I mean, you sheep. He said, I will deliver your sheep. I will take care of the shepherd that is evil. Do we believe God? I mean, that's faith. David believed God. And verse 16, David finished this saying. Saul asked him, is this your voice, David, my son? He wept aloud. You are more righteous than I. You know, you got to admit, it's come into your mind recently. You're looking, okay, who's the most righteous person? And I'll follow the most righteous person. Or the one that is least offensive. Or the one that is whatever. I mean, Saul was more righteous than David. I mean, David is more righteous than Saul, and Saul admitted that. He said, you have treated me well, and I have treated you badly. You've just now told me of the good you did to me, and the Lord delivered me into your hands, but you did not kill me. And he says, isn't the normal carnal tendency, verse 19, when a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? I mean, that's human nature. He said, may the Lord reward you well for the way you have treated me today. And verse 20, and I know that you will surely be king, and the kingdom of Israel will be established into your hands. And so he knew that David would receive that kingship, but David would receive it when God wanted David to get it. Not according to how David wanted to take it out of God's hands. Oh, we find in 1 Samuel 26, now this is about a year later, David's still on the lam and Saul didn't really recant on treating him poorly. And Saul is gathering armies here at Ziph, and he and his army went down to sleep. And so David said, does anybody want to come with me? I'm going to creep into the camp of Israel. Now you think about this, that here are 3,000 men laying around the camp. And David said, I'm going to walk right into their camp. And I'm going to approach Saul. Now you think about that. Doesn't that seem kind of stupid? You know, that if you were to walk through a camp, and especially with the king's soldiers guarding him and everything, and just walk in scot-free and do what you want, I mean, who wouldn't know that he was there? I mean, one of the men would wake up out of 3,000, wouldn't they? So I think David was putting this in God's hands and saying, okay, God, if you don't want me to get to Saul, you stop me from getting to Saul. Well, we go through verse 7. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul. They'd walked all the way through the army into the middle of the camp, and there was Saul. God didn't stop David. lying asleep in the camp with a spear struck in the ground near his head, and Abner and the soldiers were lying around him. In verse 8, and Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. I know how hesitant you were to run him through the spear in the cave. But God, this is a sign, David. We couldn't have gotten this far unless God had worked this out for you to finally be king. And I know you don't want to run him through, but I'll do it for you. So you won't even have to have that on your conscience." So he said, "Let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I don't have to strike him twice, man. I'll get him right the first time." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" Imagine this attitude that David had. "As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike him." God said, "I will strike the shepherd who is not a righteous shepherd. I will take care of the shepherd." And he said, "I'm not going to do it." He said, "The Lord will strike him, either in his time will come, he'll die of old age if God lets him, or he'll go into battle and perish. God is big enough to take care of the problem. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and the water jug there near his head and let's go." And so they grabbed these things as proof that they had been there. And then David went across the other side of the river, like out of spear's length. And he stood up, verse 14, he called to the army and to Abner, the son of Ner. And he said, "Aren't you going to answer me, Abner?" And he's yelling, you know, and Abner wakes out of his sleep. He said, "What's that? What's all that noise?" It's David yelling across to him. And notice what he tells Abner. David said, "You're a man, aren't you? Are you a man or not? Who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard the Lord your king?" David was really high on loyalty. And he just reamed Abner out for not paying attention and letting him into the camp. And he said, "Someone came to destroy your Lord, the king. What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. Look around you. Where the king's spear and water jug near his head?" It's interesting. We just go back to verse 12, the end of verse 12. Read verse 12. It says, "And David took the spear, the water jug, and near Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew about it. Nor did anyone wake up. They were all sleeping because the Lord had put them in a deep sleep." Again, God was allowing David to do what he wanted, if he will. He wanted to know what was in David's heart. And that's how God knows that David is a man after his heart, because he put him in situations where he could test his heart to see, do you have pride? Do you have rebellion? What is it that's in your heart? That's how David, that's how God knows what's in David's heart. And he again said, why are you after me? He said, I'm not after you. He said, I'll die first if I need to. Verse 23 of chapter 26 said, "The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord delivered you into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on my Lord's anointed. As surely as I valued your life today, so the Lord may value my life and deliver me from trouble." How we treat others is how God will treat us. Do unto others as you'd have them do to you. What do we want God to do to us? God will take care of things. He's big enough. Verse 25, "And Saul said to David, 'May you be blessed, my son David. You will do great things and surely triumph.'" And indeed, that's the case. You know, there's a lesson here for like anything, like even our boss. My wife works for many of you work for the state, the government. My wife works for the government of Arizona. and she works for the Department of Education. And she just got a new boss today. Her previous boss was, some people didn't like him and didn't care for him. They had things to say against him. And Kay comes back from work and says, oh, these people are running down Tom Horn, but, you know, it's not my job to run down my boss. And in the weeks since the new superintendent has come in, his name is John Hoopenthal, people have been coming and people just do the gossip talk around the office. And they'd say, oh, it's Hoopenthal, you know, he's gonna fire a bunch of people and he's just a bad guy and everything. And what do you think? And Kay says, well, I think he's probably a fine guy. I don't know him and I have no reason to, you know, run him down or whatever. And she'll just back him up because that's her boss, ultimately. And there's something to be said for loyalty. And again, I think it goes back, I really believe it goes back to God needing to test to see whether we are loyal. In whatever circumstance, whatever situation, it doesn't mean put somebody over God. But he said there are the authorities, and whether they're good or whether they're evil, there's still authorities over us, and we need to respect them. Because Lucifer somehow got one third of the angels to not be loyal to God. Now, how did he do that? How long did it take? You know, just like David, or God stepped back and let those people sleep around Saul, so God stood back and let Lucifer talk to the angels because he wanted to see what was in the angels' hearts. And a third of them thought God was a bad boss. And they wanted to get out from under and take over. And I think it all had to do, you go back to when Lucifer was put over the earth, like David was over a certain part of the army. And then God says, you know what I'm going to do? We came up with a plan to where I'm going to put these scrawny human beings, or maybe two large human beings, depending on who they are, and I'm going to put them over you eventually. And Lucifer says, well, you can't put me down. This is my position. You can't take me away from being over the world. I'm the God of this world. And indeed, God has let him be the God of this world, and it's to test mankind, it's to test you and to test me. Now, there are all kinds of circumstances that our loyalty can be tested. I think it's interesting in 1 Samuel chapter 29 and verse 6, that as David is fleeing, he actually ends up joining the Philistines. And he's working for the Philistine army. And when he was working for the Philistines, because he couldn't be in Israel, because David or Saul was trying to kill him, notice what it says in verse 6 of chapter 29. So Achish called David and said to him, as surely as the Lord lives, you have been reliable. And I would be pleased to have you serve me in the army. From the day you came to me till now, I found no fault in you. Now the rulers don't approve of you, and they don't want you to come on this march here because they think you'll probably turn on us. And it's an interesting circumstance here you might think about. And I don't believe that this current test that's going on is just about United Church of God being the test for all of God's people. I mean, I think people in the Living Church of God are being tested. That's where you are. That's where your loyalties are, and it's your church. Are you loyal to the authorities that are there? I think from CGI or United Church of God or even the new organization that is emerging, I think God, if that's where you're going, you need to learn the lesson of loyalty. And everybody needs to learn this lesson of loyalty. Everybody does. Because if we can't be, can God have us in the kingdom? So it's big, and I don't think it's just about this circumstance, but it is about loyalty, and God will put us in, and we're going to have to learn that one way or the other. Saul ends up dying. David ends up mourning and becomes king. And this one was my watch right? Well, Saul dies, David mourns, and David becomes king and God is with him. 2 Samuel chapter 5. And verse 10 says, and he became more and more powerful because the Lord God Almighty was with him. 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 15, God says, my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you some 25, 30 years ago. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me, and your throne will be established forever. And so he gives promises to David that he's going to be with him. Now, I think this is interesting when you keep in mind, we look at administrations, and we look at the administration within the rulership, and we find that the administration is not always like the best guys for the job. You'd like for them, everybody to be perfect, but David's cabinet, it says in 2 Samuel 8, verse 15, that David, 2 Samuel 8, 15, David reigned over all Israel, doing what is just and right for all his people. Now, when we say, why is David a man after God's own heart, is because he just had the best wisdom in choosing his people. He always did the right and the best thing. He always just made sure that everybody was taken care of, and he never was a bad guy. Well, you've read the book, and you know that's not the case, but why was David a man after God's own heart? Well, certainly he was repentant. Certainly he was loyal, but he did what was just and right for his people. And then it says in the next couple of verses who his cabinet was. You know, Joab was over the army, Jehoshaphat the recorder, Zadok and Abathar were priests, Sariah was secretary. Notice the last part of verse 18, it says, and David's sons were his royal advisors. Here was his cabinet. His sons were his advisors. Now, is David a man after God's own heart because he chose the wisest people? Now, David's sons here were probably between 14 and 18 years old. And David's sons were not like the best sons. We read that, and I'll skip ahead a little bit, but 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 6, speaking of Adonijah, one of his sons, it says, it gives a comment about that. It says, and his father, David, had not rebuked him at any time, saying, why have you done so? Why are you doing this? He was not a good child rearer. He didn't keep track of his sons, and we see the results. We get into 2 Samuel chapter 11, the story of Bathsheba and Uriah. Here's the situation. We say, well, David is a man after God's own heart because he repented. Well, indeed he did. But I mean, even to look at this, and this situation went on for about 9 months from the time that he started this relationship with Uriah's wife Bathsheba until the child was born and died. This circumstance went on for a while. So it's not just that any time he did something wrong, his conscience struck him immediately like it did in the cave. This time his conscience went on. Chapter 11, verse 27 says, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. And then it says in chapter 12, verse 13, that David repented. And again, we've read David's Psalm of Repentance, Psalm 51. And we follow his example of repenting when we sin. But David fell, and he fell hard. The shepherd of Israel, the king, had fallen. What do you do when your shepherd falls? What do you do if your shepherd is not good at conflict resolution, at human relations? You look at the relationship between him and his sons, and even his wives. He had many wives, actually. There was virtually no relationship between him and his sons. There's a time where he sent Absalom away because of a dastardly deed that Absalom had done that involved some of his other kids. And he wouldn't even speak to him for 2 years. And when he came back after a while, he just had this horrible relationship. So we don't look at David and say, well, David is a man after God's own heart because he had this great relationship and he knew how to do conflict resolution. That wasn't his forte. It was what was in his heart, even though his actions were sometimes less than admirable. So what do you do when the shepherd falls? Well, somebody's got to do something, right? If they're not doing the right thing. Well, yeah, that's what one of his sons thought. In fact, that's what a couple of his sons thought. We go to chapter 15 of 2 Samuel. And let's notice what happened here, because David and Absalom were not getting along. And Absalom, one of David's advisors, by the way, he worked for David in addition to being his son. And let's see what he did. Verse 15, in the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses with 50 men to run ahead of him. You notice, I mean, here are 50 guys who said, hey, Absalom's a good guy. And we need to let Absalom be our ruler, and we'll go ahead of him, and we'll break the way for him, and we'll make sure that he's successful in what he does here. And he, Absalom, would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. We actually visited some of these places in Israel where there's the chair there and the gate, and people would pass by, and they excavated some of those things. It's really kind of cool. But anyway, whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king or a decision, and I expect a lot of these things were complaint about the king and about what was going on, and well, this wasn't right, you know, and so we'll come before David with a decision. Absalom would call out to him and said, what town are you from? Hey, buddy, you know, where are you from? And the person would answer, your servant's one of the tribes. Yeah, I've been there. You know, I really enjoy that nice place. You know, he's really a nice guy. He's just very personable. And verse 3, and Absalom would say, you know, your claims are valid and proper, but there's no representative of the king to hear you. I mean, David and his cabinet, of which I'm a part of, by the way, but we won't mention that right now, they'll treat you bad. You know, they won't give you justice. You have to look for me. I will give you justice. I will help you. And Absalom would add, if only I were appointed judge in the land, if only I could be king, then everything would be all right, and you'd get out from under that awful David. Then everyone who has a complaint or a case would come to me, and I would see that he gets justice. I'm a good guy. Verse 5, and also, whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him, and say, oh, buddy, hey, we're just best friends. I'm here for you. Verse 6, Absalom behaved in this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice. So he stole the hearts of the men of Israel because the shepherd had fallen. He wasn't a very good king. Verse 7, at the end of 4 years, this went on for a long time where these types of discussions and these things were going, and as David's advisor, he was subverting David all this time. Absalom said to the king, let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow I made to the Lord while your servant was living in Gershon and Aram. I made this vow to the Lord. The Lord takes me back to Jerusalem. I'll go worship the Lord in Hebron. And the king said, well, go in peace to worship God. And remember it said about David's other son. He said David just didn't, like, keep track of him, or he wasn't very good in watching what was going on under his nose. Same with Absalom. So, Absalom goes to worship the Lord. And verse 10, and Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel. So we got this secret stuff going on. As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. And they spread this around and said, you know, Absalom, what a good guy he is. Remember you went there and he gave you this really good judgment. And of course, David would have given you a bad judgment. He said, yeah, yeah. Well, he's king now. Oh, no kidding. That's great, because we didn't like we didn't like David anyway. So now we've got a good king. And it says, verse 11, now 200 men from Jerusalem had accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing of the matter. Well, yeah, that's a good idea. Absalom's king. Much better king than David. And it wasn't that they had evil in their hearts. It wasn't that they were trying to be bad people. It's not that they were trying to rebel. It just says that Absalom had sold them such a bill of goods that they went and said, this is the right thing to do. This is great. 200 of them. It says, while Absalom was offering sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gideonite, David's counselor, to come to Gilo, his hometown. So the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's following kept on increasing. And it kept on increasing so much that there were more of them than there were of David and his people that were loyal to him. And David got run out of town again, like under Saul. And so the conspirators got the most, and David, he ended up fleeing and had to get out of there. I think we might ask the question, would we have joined Absalom if we'd have been back there? Might have. He did have a good story. He was going to relieve them from the evil oppressors. Chapter 16, we find in verse 5, when David approached Baram, a man of the same clan as Saul's family came out, his name was Shimei, and he cursed David. And he was throwing stones at David. He said, David, you're a bad guy. And David says, yeah, I guess I'm a fallen shepherd. I didn't do all the right stuff. So when somebody wanted to go kill Shimei, he said, no, let him go. Do not respond in kind. You know, David was a man after God's own heart. David was a type of Jesus Christ. And you look at Jesus Christ, and it said when he was reviled, he reviled not again. When they persecuted Christ, he didn't strike back. He didn't call down the armies of heaven to strike these people dead. He just let it go and put it in God's hands. David was a man after God's own heart. It's exactly what Jesus Christ did. When Jesus Christ was removed from his power over the entire universe and became a man and suffered at the hands of others. That was Christ's example. And in type, it was David's example here. Absalom ends up dying. And we see that David was a man after God's own heart, but he really wasn't the wisest in how he handled things and how he handled people. His human relations weren't very good. He was mourning over the death of Absalom, chapter 19, verse 1, and he was just sobbing after Absalom dying, and even after all the stuff that Absalom had done to him. And verse 5, and Joab went to the house of the king. So here's Joab, and remember, Joab's a good guy here, right? He's David's chief army guy. You know, he's bailing David out of this bad circumstance here. Joab went into the house of the king to say, today you have humiliated all your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. Verse 6, you love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You've made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. David, you're really messing up here. You know, these guys saved you, and that you're crying for Absalom, who was doing bad to you. And you're not thanking these guys for saving your life. And he said, I see you'd be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out and do it, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. You have alienated the troops. And they're just going to leave you because you didn't handle this situation very well. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you from your youth till now. Well, thankfully, David listened to Joab, and he went out and he told, hey, guys, thank you. You know, I didn't mean to make you feel as though wasn't appreciative when I was weeping for Absalom, but he's my son. It just shows David wasn't perfect in those ways. I get thinking that God in the kingdom wants us to be always able to do conflict resolution and to handle things exactly perfectly so he can use us in the kingdom. David, right up till the time of his death, had imperfections. You know, kind of like Paul. He said, the things I want to do, I don't. The things I should do, I don't do them. The things I don't want to do, I do. You know, God's looking for our hearts, even though sometimes our actions aren't exactly as they ought to be. I'm thankful for God's mercy. Mercy, judgment, and faith. Oh, let's see. Chapter 19, verse 40, I think is kind of funny. So, okay, David's been fleeing, and now he's about ready to come back to Jerusalem, and he's about to cross the Jordan River to come back triumphantly into Jerusalem to take his rightful place as the king. And you'd think, well, David, he's going to be over all Israel, he's going to bring peace, and everybody's going to get along under David. Well, they will in the world tomorrow. It'll happen. But is it because he was such a good peacemaker? Is it because he was such a good ruler, he stopped contentions under his rule? Okay, verse 40. It says, when the king crossed over till Gilgal, Kiram crossed with him, and all the troops of Judah and half the troops of Israel had taken the king over. So they're going back across the Jordan, about to ascend the hill to go back up to Jerusalem, and David take his rightful place as king. And so you got these bunch of people coming with them from Judah and a bunch of people coming with them from Israel. And let's see if any of this sounds vaguely familiar. Soon, all the men were coming to the king. Verse 41. Soon all the men of Israel were coming to the king, saying to him, why did our brothers, the men of Judah, steal the king away and bring him and his household across the Jordan River together with all these men? What are the guys from Judah doing there? We're the ones, you know, that have been on your side and saved you, you know? And what are they doing there? Well, and then the men of Judah, verse 42. And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, well, we did this because the king is closely related to us. Why are you angry about it? Have we eaten any of the king's provisions? Have we taken anything ourselves? Well, we're Judah, and he's from the tribe of Judah, and so he's closer than you are. In verse 43. And then the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king, and besides, we have a greater claim on David than you have. Why did you treat us with contempt? Were we not the first to speak to the king and bring our king back? And then the guys from Judah said, but the men of Judah responded even more harshly than the men of Israel. A couple of weeks ago when I was here, Tammy said, I have two words for these guys. Grow up. She wasn't talking about this specifically, but circumstances like this that have happened all through history and still happen. And you think, all right, whatever. Now we find David coming back, and you think, okay, well, people be happy with David. I mean, after all, he's king of Israel, man after God's own heart. Verse 20. Now a troublemaker named Sheba, this is chapter 20, verse 1. Now a troublemaker named Sheba, son of Bichri, a Benjamite, happened to be there, and he sounded the trumpet and said, we have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son, every man to his tent, O Israel. He said, I'll solve this thing. So you guys of Israel, you come with me. And we'll just let David go with his guys from Judah. We'll show him. So the men of Israel deserted David to follow Sheba, son of Bichri. And the men of Judah stayed with their king all the way from Jordan to Jerusalem. They had a split before the kingdoms of Israel split under Jeroboam and Rehoboam. And so David has this split. Now David went back to Jerusalem, and we find what happened with Sheba, who split off from David. You see, this is what you think, well, if only we had David as our ruler, we wouldn't have any splits. Yeah, we would, because we're stinking carnal sometimes. Okay. Chapter 20, verse 21. Anyway, the guy came, and they're going after Sheba. He said, "A man named Sheba, son of Bichri from the hill country of Ephraim, lifted up his hand against the king, against David. Hand over this one man, and I'll withdraw from the city." And the woman said to Joab, "His head will be thrown to you from the wall." And certainly they went and found Sheba, who had taken the men of Israel, made this split, and they threw Sheba's head over the wall, and then the guys left the city alone. So that's what happened when this guy decided he didn't want to be under King David. Even though King David was a shepherd who was less than perfect. Chapter 24. We find just fairly shortly before the death of David that David ends up counting Israel. Verse 2. "So the king said to Joab and the army commanders with him, 'Go throughout the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and enroll the fighting men that they may know how many there are.'" Now, God had warned them against numbering Israel because we like to say, well, if we got this many guys, then we can win the battle. And we like to count guys, you know, and say, we can win because we have this many with us. And God says, no, don't do that, because I am the one who will take care of you. And I am the one who sets up and takes down, so don't you go numbering Israel. Now, Joab comes back. Remember, Joab is the one who saved David from this disaster of his army deserting him, because he said, look, go and thank them. Okay, so Joab comes back and replied to the king, "May the Lord your God multiply the troops 100 times over in the eyes of the Lord my king and see it. But why does the Lord my king want to do such a thing in numbering Israel?" And the king's word, however, overruled Joab and the army commanders, and they left the presence of the king to enroll the fighting men of Israel. You can't go back and second guess and things, but I think this would have been one of the times when Joab should have said, "No, David, if you want to number Israel, you can't count me in, because God doesn't want us numbering Israel, and even though you're the king, I've got to obey God rather than man." I think this is one of the times that Joab should have stood up and just said, "Kill me if you have to, but I'm not going to disobey God." But anyway, they went through. It took 9 months. Again, we say David's after man's own heart. David is a man after God's own heart because he repents. Here another. It took 9 months before finally, verse 10, David was conscience-stricken after he had counted the fighting men. And he said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I have done. O Lord, I beg you, take away the guilt of your servant. I've done a very foolish thing." He behaved foolishly. He went against the bylaws, if you will, what God said. And David said, please don't let this happen. Verse 15, the Lord sent a plague on Israel from morning until the end of time designated. 70,000 people from Dan to Beersheba died because the shepherd had fallen. The sheep suffered as a result of David being very unwise in disobeying God. So when the sheep or the shepherds mess up, the sheep are affected. The sheep scatter. People's lives are hurt. And indeed, when there's sin, when there is wrong action, you suffer the consequences, just like God said, put a king over Israel, but don't come crying to me, you know, if it goes south. And we do our own carnal nature, and people are hurt. You know, David, he puts it in these terms too. Verse 17, when David saw the angel who was striking down the people, he said, "Lord, I'm the one who sinned and done wrong, but these are my sheep. What have they done? Let your hand fall on me and my family." So the shepherd fell and the sheep got hurt. The sheep were scattered. 70,000 died. So you see, David wasn't like so perfect is why he was a man after God's own heart. So when we start looking for perfection as a gauge for our leaders, you don't have a very good gauge because we don't have it. We have to look to other things. Now let's go to 1 Kings Chapter 1 and verse 1, when David was old and well advanced in years, and he was sick, and they gave him a heating pad. And verse 5. Now Adonijah is another one of the king's advisors. Okay, so his sons were his advisors, and another one of his sons. Now Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, put himself forward and said, "I'll be king. I decided I want to be king. I decide I don't want God to appoint it or David to appoint it. I'll take it into my own hands." And so he got chariots and horses ready with 50 men to run ahead of him. Same thing that Absalom had done. Work for Absalom, could work for me. So I'll get all these guys on my side, and they'll run ahead of me. And his father had never interfered with him by asking, "Why do you behave as you do?" And he also was very handsome and was born next after Absalom. Very striking looking guy. Not only was he had this good personality and everything like Absalom, very attractive, and you know the gals just falling all over him. And here's how Adonijah decided what to do when he wanted to be king. Adonijah conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they gave him their support. So he talks to Joab. Remember Joab, he's the one that saved David's skin. He's the one that advised him against counting Israel, and he had been at David's side all this time, and Adonijah got Joab on his side. And he got Abiathar the priest on his side. And so he had all these really well-respected guys on his side, and they gave him their support. But Zadok the priest, and Benaiah son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet, and even Shemaiah, and Rei, and David's special guard did not join Adonijah. So you've got a bunch of good guys joining Adonijah, and you got a bunch of good guys not joining Adonijah. And so you look and say, well, who are the best guys? I mean, Joab, good guy. Abiathar the priest, good guy. Well, so is Nathan, good guy. And as you start looking, well, who's the best guy? And verse 9, and Adonijah then sacrificed sheep and cattle and fattened calves at the stone of Zoleth near Enroigel, and invited all his brothers. This is who he invited to his party, if you will. Invited all his brothers, the king's sons. So he got all of David's advisors, because it said his sons were his advisors. So he got Joab, he got Abiathar, he got the king's advisors, and all the men of Judah who were royal officials. We got the guy with the best titles. But he did not invite Nathan the prophet or Benaiah or the special guard or his brother Solomon. We don't want to invite those guys because they might blow the whistle on us. We don't want to invite those guys because they might tell us you're doing the wrong thing. And we don't want to hear that. Well, verse 17, well, Nathan, verse 11, asked Bathsheba, "Have you not heard Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king without the Lord our David's knowing it?" Went around behind his back. In verse 17, she said, "My Lord, you yourself swore to me, your servant, by the Lord God, Solomon shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne." And now Adonijah made himself king. Well, we find David had other plans there. Adonijah eventually was killed for his presumptuous act. And we find in 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 1, as we end not only to the near the end of David's life, we near the end of the sermon. The time drew near for the sermon to end and for David to die. And he gave charge to Solomon his son, and he said, "I'm about to die. Be strong, show yourself a man, observe what the Lord your God requires, walk in his ways, keep my decrees and commands, his laws, his requirements, as written in the law of Moses, so you may prosper in all you do and where you go." You got to follow God's way, follow God's laws, and you'll be successful. And then he says, now there's Joab, verse 5. And he said, Joab, there was another issue that occurred with Joab, and I think this past issue with Joab, with Adonijah, had something to do with it. But he says, verse 6, deal with him according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down unto the grave in peace. See, God knows what goes on. He knows what's in people's hearts. And God will take care of situations. So he said, verse 7, show kindness to the sons of Barzillai of Gilead. Let them be among those who eat at your table. They stood by me when I fled from your brother Absalom. When I was down and out, when Absalom rebelled and took over the kingdom, he said, Barzillai stood by me. He was faithful. He was loyal. You can count on him. Make him part of your team. And he says, verse 8, remember, you also have Shimei on your side, but you got to watch Shimei. And he goes on to say, I promised that I would not kill Shimei as long as I lived, but I'm dying. And he says, verse 9, but now do not consider him innocent. You're a man of wisdom. You will know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. Because when I was down and out, Shimei was throwing stones at me. Barzillai was helping me. Shimei was throwing stones. Now, which one do we want to be? Verse 10, David rested with his fathers, was buried in the city of David. And he had reigned 40 years over Israel. And Solomon sat on the throne, firmly established. We have stories that, in many ways, could mirror situations that have taken place through history and even taking place today. God gives us principles to live by, and he thoroughly equips us through the scriptures to be the man and the woman he wants us to be. And he tells us what to do when a shepherd falls.